This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
I want us to spend some time now considering the story of English Baptist and that tradition, which of course is so influential here in the United States. In fact, statistics indicate that there are at least 50 different ecclesiastical Baptistic groups here in the United States that use the title Baptist in their denominational nomenclature. Indeed, Baptists are the second largest Christian group in the United States, of course, second to Roman Catholics. And Southern Baptists, of course, would be the largest numbers, somewhere between 15 and 16 million members in the United States, especially in the South. As we like to say, in the South, there are more Baptists than there are people. But when we think about their heritage in the context of Old England and then coming over to America, I think Kenneth Latourette has made a poignant statement in his history of Christianity about why it is that we don't have as clear a picture of Baptist history as, say, we do some of the other traditions. You know, for many of the other Protestant families of faith, we can point to an individual leader, kind of as the headwaters of that movement, but it's a little bit different among the Baptists, and a part of why there are different ways that the story is sometimes told. But Latourette has made this statement. Let me quote. Latourette says, "It's been the special privilege given to Baptists more than any other body of Christians of comparable size to preach the gospel to the poor. For the most part, the poor leave no written traces of their lives. And the historian is often baffled when he seeks to reconstruct what they have said and done. For this reason, no history of the Baptist can ever be complete." And I think that's probably a rather accurate statement. And part of the reason why there traditionally have been probably four different perspectives on the Baptist history, and I want to just mention those for you now. And particularly for you Baptist students, probably you've heard one or more of these traditions as a part of the Baptist story. One particular angle on telling the Baptist history is to focus on its continental origins. That is, thinking back toward the emergence of the Anabaptists there in Zurich and seeing really the emergence of the uniquely Baptist persuasion there among the early Swiss brethren, and then seeing that pass down through Europe and later over into Holland and England, and the Baptist tradition having its heritage there. Now, there's a smaller story that's told. Sometimes it's referred to as landmarkism or the silver line of grace, or some even refer to it as the trail of blood, which basically argues in tracing the Baptist movement back to earliest New Testament Christianity and wanting to say that, well, you know, Baptists really aren't even Protestants. They were not part of the Protestant Reformation, and there's just kind of been this succession of Baptistic churches through the early church, these different sects during the Middle Ages, and so this Baptist influence is kind of passed down to our time today. Usually no bona fide Baptist historians embrace those ideas, but you do hear it, particularly sometimes in fundamentalist circles. I remember my experience as a young pastor going and visiting an older couple that had visited the church, and I recall during that visit in the early 80s, hearing the gentleman proceed to give me his perspective on this silver line of grace, the fact that Baptists are the only true church, have always existed in kind of uninterrupted succession from the early centuries. And I had this deep sense that this was nonsense, and I never heard this before. But being a good little boy, I sat and listened respectfully to that. But that was my first introduction kind of to that particular take on Baptist history. In addition to those, the most accepted explanation of Baptist history would be those that tied in not to the Reformation of the 16th century in Zurich, nor this uninterrupted succession of Baptistic movements, but to the Puritan movement in England. A couple of different varieties of that. One of the perspectives of the Baptist movement coming out of the Separatist movement in England would tend to focus on these Puritan Calvinists that were congregationalists, and that the core of the movement had to do with their understanding of church government. Not being Presbyterian nor Anglican or certainly Roman Catholic, but this this independent movement in England that some of these Separatists fled to Holland, embraced by some of the Mennonites there, then returning to England and establishing the General Baptist movement in England in the early 17th century. Another variation on that would also tie into the Congregationalist movement there in England, but would tend to underscore the notion of believers' baptism is central to that, that these Puritan Congregationalists turned Baptist, then by the 1640s, adopting the particular Baptist confession of 1644, or what we would call the Old London Confession, which paralleled in many ways the Westminster Confession of Faith. So really a variation of whether you emphasize what we would call the general Baptist heritage or the particular Baptist heritage. Particular Baptist, that nomenclature pointing to their understanding of particular atonement or definite atonement in a more strict Calvinistic sense. And this seems would be the main take that most Baptist historians would embrace, that the English Baptist heritage emerges out of Puritanism in England. And so that is the line of the story that I would like to trace for us as we talk about the English Baptist heritage. So separate from the Anabaptist movement, and I think most of you that would have any experience with Southern Baptists know that there's not a whole lot that a Mennonite and a Southern Baptist would have in common, other than their particular views about believers' baptism. Very different traditions, and that's kind of a no-brainer. All right, well, as we look at the roots then of the English Baptist movement in the 17th century, and the upheaval that took place beginning with Henry VIII, as we have looked at the story of the English Reformation, and this separatist movement then that will begin to develop during the time of James I. You remember we talked about how James had made it clear that he was going to expect that all Englishmen conform to the Church of England and the Book of Common Prayer. And at this point, some of the separatists that are not too willing to live with that, some will go to Holland and then return back to England. Others, those among the Pilgrim Fathers, we more identify as Congregationalists, that would continue to practice infant baptism, for example, in the New World, came to America by 1620 and the Plymouth settlement there in Massachusetts. Well, two names that we identify with the early English Baptist movement would be John Smith, his dates of 1570 to 1612, and a Thomas Helwys. We're not as clear about Thomas Helwys' birth, but his death, 1616. So we're talking about the early decades of the 17th century. John Smith had been an Anglican priest. He'd studied at Christ College, Cambridge, and becomes the leader of a separatist group in the area of Gainsborough, in the border of Nottinghamshire in the English Midlands. And this group at Gainsborough had formed a covenanted church. That is, a church that had organized themselves according to a church covenant, this sacred bond together that they would follow Christ in this community of faith together. He became the leader of this group, and Thomas Helwys would join this group of dissenters eventually. And he and his wife would connect with them in 1608. He was educated at Gray's Inn. The Gainsborough group would arrive in Amsterdam, and there in 1608-1609, they are given hospitality by the Mennonites there in Holland. And here, for the first time, they begin to freely examine their faith in the light of the New Testament as they understood it. And Smith concludes that the baptism should only be given to believers and not to the children of believers. And so in 1609, he baptizes himself, baptizes Helwys, and the rest of the group. And thus, in many ways, English baptism is born, because this symbolic act pointed to their declaration of complete independence from the old English state church, because they declared their infant baptism invalid by rebaptizing themselves. But it also marked a separation from some of the other separatist groups, the Congregationalists in England, who would continue, who would agree certainly with these Baptists in terms of independent local church autonomy, but disagreed about the practice of baptism. Well, in February of 1610, Smith and 31 others actually came to the conclusion that they had been wrong to rebaptize themselves, and they concluded that there was no legitimate grounds for them. There was no ecclesiastical covering or authority which legitimized this, that they did not have the right to take it upon themselves to do this. And so they connected with the Mennonites and joined with them there in Holland. But this is where Helwys becomes very important in the story of the General Baptist movement and the formation of the first Baptist church in England, or what we would say General Baptist Church. Helwys and 12 others disagree with Smith, and they return to England. And in 1612, they set up an English Baptist congregation in Spitalfields near London. And the group continued to grow, and by 1625, there were congregations in Lincoln, Coventry, Salisbury, and Tiverton. And so the English Baptist movement is beginning to spread. During this time, Thomas Helwys writes a little treatise identified with him, addressed to King James, entitled The Mystery of Iniquity. And here he exhorts the king to stop imposing your laws on the consciences of your subjects. And, of course, Baptists are famous for their push for religious freedom and toleration. They always seem to be bear the brunt of oppression, and not only in Britain, but also in America. But Helwys appealed to the king, and he said, you have civil authority, but you have no authority in the church. You are a mere layman in terms of ecclesiastical affairs. Well, he got imprisoned for this, and would eventually cost him his life as he dies in Newgate Prison in 1616. So Thomas Helwys and John Smith. Now the story of particular Baptist in England takes some other directions. Again, these were the more strictly Calvinistic London separatists. And a man by the name of Henry Jacob established a church along this gathered church principle of covenanting together in the year 1616 in Southwark near London. And they had adopted believers' baptism, this idea, and then finally by this 1640 he had come to the conviction that immersion was the only mode of scriptural baptism. So you kind of have an evolution among these English Baptists, certainly coming to embrace congregational government, then exclusive believers baptism, which early on they practiced by sprinkling or effusion, pouring, and then deciding that, no, we really are convinced that immersion is the only legitimate form of Christian baptism. So by the 1640s, the particular Baptist had come to that perspective. Seven London Baptist churches published this confession in 1644. The famous London Confession. There's going to be a second London Confession, which more particularly would model the Westminster Confession. But some of the principles are laid out in this original London Confession that we identify with the Baptist movement. Baptism, according to the London Confession, was the door of Christian fellowship. Members of the church was only for those who professed faith in Christ personally and had received believers' baptism. The ministry was completely under the control of the church members of the covenanted community. No role of any kind of bishop in terms of ordination. This was done in the local congregation under their authority. And they committed to the principle that there should be no state interference in church matters. The independency of the church was important. And they affirmed this notion of mutual cooperation among the churches, working together in terms of church planting, assisting each other financially, and if there were controversies, to work these things out together. Of course, in Baptist circles, it was always the sense of advice to churches, because local church autonomy was very important and very different from Presbyterians, where presbyteries would have authority over local churches and could make determinations that were determinative for those local churches, whereas in Baptist circles where they did collaborate, this was only an advisory capacity because local churches were autonomous. Well, the Baptist movement would continue to grow during the time of the English Civil War and into the period of the Interregnum, that is the reign of Oliver Cromwell and the short reign of his son, before the Restoration in 1660 under Charles II. Many particular Baptists served in the parliamentary army. And a part of the way that the Baptist movement spread is as the armies traveled throughout England, many of these Baptists would establish churches in different areas. So the church spread in England, Wales, and also into Ireland in the 1650s and 1660s. Well, during the time as we move toward the period of the Restoration in 1660, where Charles II comes back to the throne, there are basically three significant dissenting groups. You had your Baptists, your Independents or Congregationalists, and your Presbyterians. Now, under the auspices of Charles II, the famous Savoy Conference was established in the 1660s, where they met together, and there were 12 bishops and 12 Presbyterians that got together to see if they could revise the Book of Common Prayer and make it acceptable to the different groups in England, because Charles II was wanting to reinstitute a uniformity. Remember, under Cromwell, there had been very free religious toleration, with the exception of Quakers and Roman Catholics in England. But now the new king is wanting to bring everyone under the constraints of the Church of England again. Now, Richard Baxter had put forward his own service book, one of the Independents, and one of his great appeals was, please do not impose upon us a mandatory ordination under the hands of the bishops. Please recognize independent, ordination. And that was decided against as a part of the Savoy Conference, and this was one of the reasons that many of the Presbyterians rejected. The Presbyterians were pushing for a number of changes in the Book of Common Prayer. They wanted to omit the imposition of the commemoration of Lent and Saints' Days. They wanted to push more for the use of the Authorized Bible or the King James Version and not the Great Bible. They objected to the use of the word priest in the Book of Common Prayer, wanted to substitute the word minister, and also liked to use the word Lord's Day instead of Sunday. But the Presbyterians would reject the outcome. There were very minor revisions made to the Book of Common Prayer as a part of the Savoy Conference, and the new Book of Common Prayer in 1662 was rejected by the Presbyterians as well as the Baptists and Independents, and over 2,000 of the Presbyterians lost their pulpits during this time. And this is when many of the Baptists were in prison, lost their pulpits. Most well known would be, of course, John Bunyan during this time that we'll talk about momentarily. Well, to play the story of English history out during this time, eventually James II will come to the throne and he will flee. And then William of Orange, we've already made mention of during William and Mary, will issue the famous Act of Toleration in 1689 so that all Trinitarian Protestants will have the free practice of their religion in England. As long as they swore allegiance to the king, paid their tithes to the English church, they could freely practice their faith. They could get a license to set up meeting houses. And they were allowed exceptions to the 39 Articles, such as for Baptists, their objection to infant baptism and that kind of thing. The only caveat, and this is very significant, is none of these dissenting Protestants could hold office in the civic affairs in England, but could freely practice their faith. And that was a real significant turning point in English religious history. The Baptists, along with the Presbyterians and other dissenters, were beneficiaries of this, and certainly the Baptist would. Now, we mentioned the Second London Confession, 1677, and then publicly published in 1689 as a result of this Act of Toleration. They go back and modify again the old Westminster Confession with some of its obvious differences in terms of form of government and views of baptism. And this is indeed the precursor to the famous Philadelphia Confession. We talk about the colonies in America in 1742, where the Philadelphia Baptist Association would adopt a Calvinistic confession of faith. And certainly it is most fair to say that, the English Baptist history is certainly tied very closely to the Calvinistic heritage in England. Baptists continue to have their intramural debates about that today, but the history seems to be rather clear about that. English Baptists by 1679 would establish Bristol Baptist Academy, which by the 1720s would begin producing not only ministers for Baptist churches in Britain, but also for America. And that's a very important part of the story. And the Baptist movement would from England would carry back to the continent, and you'd have Baptist churches in Germany, eventually into Eastern Europe, into Russia, and much of that would have its roots back in the English Baptist movement, as the faith then would spread into Western Europe from England. And then, of course, spread to the New World then by these Baptist ministers that would bring the gospel over to colonial America. And founding of Rhode Island College in 1764, what we would know today as Brown University, the first Baptist institution of higher education in the New World. You know, we don't have a time within the purview of this course, which really is supposed to cover up through the 18th century a number of the other well-known Baptist leaders, but let me just at least mention a few of those. I am going to talk about John Bunyan and William Carey, who I would consider certainly two of the most important with long-term influence in the Baptist movement. We certainly could mention John Gill, the Baptist theologian who died in 1771, Andrew Fuller, famous Baptist preacher of the 18th, early 19th century, and of course most well known, if we move into the 19th century, the famous evangelist and preacher Charles Haddon Spurgeon, famously involved with some of the tension in the Baptist movement and what's known as the downgrade controversy, and an Arminian wing of the particular Baptist eventually joining up with the General Baptist connection in 1891 for the Baptist Union. But indeed, Reformed Baptists would trace their lineage back to the 19th century to Spurgeon and the Reformed Baptists during that particular era. Well, let me move now to talk about one of the most beloved of the English Baptists, the great John Bunyan. And he is an outstanding example, I think, of the Baptist lineage, this very poor, uneducated man who is converted, who God mightily used both in his evangelistic efforts and his unique writing ability that God gave him that would really forever touch not only the Baptist movement, but all of Protestantism. John Bunyan, or as he was belovingly known as Bishop Bunyan, later on because of his travels around Britain in his evangelistic ministry. John Bunyan, born in 1628, died 1688. Born in the little community of Elstow near Bedford, England, his father was a tinker, that is, a mender of pots, kettles, and pans. Very meager living, very little education that Bunyan had as a boy. At the age of 16, in 1644, he enters the Parliamentary Army. We're not certain if he actually ever fought in any of the battles with the Royal Army. He never really mentions this. Likely he could have. But we do know that after 3 years, his company was disbanded and he returned to his life as a tinker. Bunyan, we know, loved music. We have accounts during his imprisonment that he actually, with his abilities in metals, he hammered out a violin made of iron at one point and took the leg of a stool in his prison cell and made a flute out of it. So a lover of music. He was married twice. We don't really know the name of his first wife. He had four children with her, and one daughter, Mary, who was blind. And his second wife was Elizabeth, and he had two children with her. In the 1650s, he recounts a significant encounter that was significant for his own conversion experience. One day he overhears a conversation of four poor women talking about the things of God, and he records this. He said, "When I heard these women, I thought that they were speaking of this joy, in speaking of the pleasantness of their joy in the Lord in Scripture language that gave such an appearance of grace in all that they said. It was to me as if they had found a new world." And this made a strong impression upon him. Also during this time, he had met a particular Baptist minister named John Gifford. And Gifford was a part of the Baptistic movement that practiced what was known as open communion, that I'll explain a little bit later. But he became part of this particular Baptist congregation in Bedford that began to give him counsel as he began to listen to this, and meanwhile begins to think seriously about his faith and is converted. Now, in the year 1660, as a result of the Conventicles Act, which Charles II issued, remember this is the year of the Restoration, after the Cromwell's son is removed from power, and now the king and the monarchy is restored, and it became illegal to hold these dissenting religious meetings, that is, meetings that did not utilize the Book of Common Prayer. Bunyan refused to assure authorities that he would desist from his preaching, so he's put in prison at first for only about 3 months in Bedford, but then long term would be in prison about 11 years. We do know that people were able to visit him in prison, and an interesting tidbit, we have records from the Bedford congregation, which, by the way, is still an active congregation today. I have visited and worshipped with that congregation, member of two different Baptistic denominations, kind of has joint membership today, but a vibrant congregation, small, but continues to meet this day in Bedford. But we have on the records of that church the fact that Bunyan was actually in attendance on several occasions during those 11 years while he technically was a prisoner. And so it gives us an indication that he was able to get about and travel at least on occasion. But during those years in prison, we know he made shoelaces to help support his family, shared the gospel with his fellow prisoners, and produced a number of his writings during his years in prisons. Overall, from the pen of Bunyan, we will have about 60 pieces, some of the most well-known, in addition to Pilgrim's Progress, would be Grace Abounding to the Chiefs of Sinners, The Holy War, The Life and Death of Mr. Badman. His last book was entitled A Book for Boys and Girls, but a prolific writer. But it was during those years in prison between 1667 and 1672 that he began his work on Pilgrim's Progress. If you've never read that, it's one of the great masterpieces of this era, and you definitely ought to avail yourself of that. From his childhood experience there, he records in very graphic imagery this journey of a Christian of making his way to the celestial city and all the personalities that he encounters along the way, going through the infamous Slough of Despond, his encounter with evangelist. You have the beautiful picture of him coming up to the cross and this burden that he had been carrying on his back along the journey there at the foot of the cross falls off his back. And then eventually entering the celestial city at the end. If you ever visit that part of England, you'll see the little grassy area there in Bedford where the local fair took place, which many believe was the picture from his childhood of Vanity Fair, which shows up there in Pilgrim's Progress. But a lot of those images from his own experience then as a child and coming to faith then become a part of this story of Pilgrim's Progress, and gives us this really insightful picture on the journey of faith and the difficulties that we face in the Christian life. It's actually John Bunyan who would recommend to his own publisher this book by Bunyan, and immediately becomes popular. By 1692, there are over 100,000 copies of this book translated into many languages, and indeed in much of the missionary work of the English missionaries and generations to come, second only to translating the Bible into the language of people that didn't have the Word of God, would be the translation of Pilgrim's Progress into the languages of a variety of peoples, and one of the great treasures of the church. Well, in January of 1672, he is released from prison, called to be the pastor of the Bedford congregation. And under this declaration of indulgence, he's given a license to preach at this congregational meeting house. And here he would not only minister to his congregation, but preach in the villages around Bedford and in London. Kept up his writing over the years, producing more books. Well, his death, we know he was riding on horseback from Reading to London in a very heavy rain, catches a fever in August of 1688, and dies in the home of a London friend, and is buried in Bunhill Fields in London. Bunhill Fields, by the way, is just across the street from the Wesley House there in London. And many of the famous Puritans are buried there in Bunhill Fields, and you can find the famous burial spot of the great John Bunyan. One particular controversy I want to just mention during Bunyan's life, it's one that's been very fascinating to me, and I think is probably still ongoing in Baptist circles today, and it has to do with the whole question of mixed communion. And Bunyan was clearly on one side of this issue. The question was, and we have from his pen some writings related to this debate, the question for Baptists during Bunyan's era in the 17th century was, should we practice strict, that is, or closed communion, that is, confining membership only to those who had been baptized as believers, and obviously means only those who have been baptized as believers are welcome to the Lord's table in our fellowships? Or should we leave the question of baptism to individual consciences? Now, most particular Baptists did practice more strict or closed communion, but there were exceptions, like Bunyan's church in Bedford and a number of others. Now, one of his famous opponents was a man by the name of William Kiffin, who died in 1701, was one of Bunyan's key opponents, and we have several written exchanges between these men. Kiffin had organized the first particular Baptist church in Devonshire Square, where he served as pastor for over 60 years. That's very impressive. He had joined the church of Henry Jacob there. But Kiffin was a very wealthy merchant. He traded in wool. In fact, at one point he loaned King Charles over 10,000 pounds. I'd say you'd be a very prominent businessman if you are known for loaning the king money. But he was able to gain some influence with King Charles II for his fellow Baptists. But Kiffin was very distressed that Bunyan was, from his perspective, far too liberal on the issue of baptism, and Kiffin pressed Bunyan for a more strict view. For Bunyan there in his Bedford church would not exclude people from membership or communion based upon how or when they were baptized. And Bunyan wrote about this. If you look in the collection of Bunyan works, you will find one of his works entitled Differences in Judgment About Water Baptism, No Bar to Communion. Well, Kiffin's also known for a famous debate that he had with one of the Anglican clergymen. And this was a debate that he had with Daniel Featley. And Featley ends up writing a little treatise on baptism where he chronicles some of the discussion that took place there with William Kiffin and three other Baptists met in the city of Southwark and in the year 1645 and had the debate took place in 1642. Wheatley's book was published in 1645, telling about the debate where they argued about, infant baptism. Here's the you'll love this title if you never heard of it, by Daniel Featley. It was entitled "The Dippers Dipped, or the Anabaptists Ducked and Plunged Over Head and Ears at a Disputation in Southwark," describing in lively terms his earlier arguments with the Baptists. Now, just a side note, Featley is well known as one of only two Episcopalians that participated in the Westminster Assembly. Now, he was Anglican by conviction, believed in the right of bishops to rule in the church, and actually was expelled from the Westminster Assembly and only participated for about 3 months during one of the early summers. Many considered him a spy for the king. The king was Charles I's holed up in Oxford at this time. But he did participate in the early debates about the revision of the 39 Articles, and we have a record of some of his speeches there. So Featley, known for Westminster Assembly, but probably most famous for his Dippers Dipped book versus Kiffin and the English Baptists. But I encourage you to consider that, those of you of the Baptist tradition. I think it's still an open question and one very important for a Baptist to consider. And I have been intrigued to see some American Baptists open up that question in recent years, and of course the Baptist churches are free to practice as they want on this issue, that more and more Baptists are deciding that they're not going to rebaptize people that join their church if they receive baptism as infants, and will welcome them into membership and partake of the Lord's Supper, although most Baptists continue to embrace Kiffin's more strict view upon these things. Now, the other Baptist that I must mention is the beloved William Carey. Carey, often given the honorific title, the Father of Modern Missions. Indeed, when we think about the Baptist heritage, we immediately think of missions. I believe that it's still a fact that the Board of Missions of the Southern Baptist Convention is still the largest missions organization in the world. And Baptists are notorious for their commitment to world evangelization, one of their great strengths and contributions to the body of Christ. And certainly at the headwaters of that movement would be the emergence of the English Baptist missionary impulse under the influence of William Carey. William Carey's dates 1761 to 1834. Moving just beyond our purview into the early part of the 19th century, but I would be remiss if I didn't say a few things about the great William Carey. In many ways, I think his life is a real picture of the challenging call to world missions. Born in August of 1761 to poor parents in a rural village of Pollersbury, England, his father had taught reading to the children and had served as a clerk to the parish priest for some extra income. So Carey would have been raised, as most good English boys, attending church in a Church of England on Sundays. But we do know that as a young boy, he had quite a big imagination, and he was particularly fascinated with Christopher Columbus. In fact, that was his nickname that his friends had given to him. Very interested in world travel and kind of the world around him. As an As an adolescent, he became an apprentice to a cobbler and worked in that shop. And there he encountered a Congregationalist who tried to convert him to the faith. And he would later on say that he began to experience real experimental religion. And basically that meant a true piety, not just outward expressions of the faith, but what a heartfelt religion. Well, after 3 years, at the age of 17, he turned his life over to Christ. And from his own account, significant for that point of conversion, it was a national day of prayer and was actually called for in England. It was a national day of prayer during the War of Independence with England. And here, the English then had called for good English men and women to gather in the churches to pray for the War of Independence and the battle with the Americans. And it was during this time of prayer that he really had his heart moved during that congregational time of worship. And he says this about his connection with the Baptist movement. He says, "I think I had a desire to follow Christ, but I concluded that the Church of England, as established by law, was the camp in which all were protected from the scandal of the cross, and that I ought to bear the reproach of Christ among dissenters." So he borrowed, after his conversion, he borrowed a Greek grammar and began to teach himself Greek. And this began his interest in languages, which was so important for him for the future. Well, he joins the Baptist, then marries Dorothy or Molly Plackett. And he had been given a shoemaking business because he had worked in this shop, and when the owner died, given to him, but not a very good businessman, and didn't make a go of that. He tried to supplement his income by teaching, wasn't really good at that, but continued on in his language study and started to do a little preaching on the side. But he heard the great preacher Andrew Fuller, who served a number of congregations in England, was very influenced by Fuller's book, a book that was published in 1785 entitled The Gospel Worthy of All Acceptance. And this was a book that Fuller had written to counteract the influence of some of the extreme Calvinists that had taken the attitude, well, you know, God will save the heathen in his own good time, and he doesn't need you and me to do it. Kind of a perversion of Calvinism. Sometimes we refer to it as hyper-Calvinism. And Fuller was opposed to that, and it made a lasting influence on Carey at this time. So he becomes a particular Baptist, rebaptized in 1783. Now, he also during this time had read a copy of Captain Cook's Voyages and became fascinated with the story of these journeys to the South Seas. Began thinking about distant lands and people, and he says that this sparked his interest in missions. In 1785, he becomes a preacher at a small Baptist church in Moulton. Three sons would be born to he and Molly. He continued to supplement his income by teaching, and then also turned back to shoemaking when some of the students left. So not making a go of it at either one of those trades. He began to pursue ordination, but this too was resisted by some of his fellow Baptists at the time. They didn't like his sermons, his lack of sermon illustration, so they delayed his ordination for about 2 years, but eventually they laid hands on him and ordained him, Fuller and several others, who would become a part of the Baptist Missionary Society that would be organized under Carey's leadership. Well, Carey's concern for world missions continued to grow. Looking at the larger world, he began to read more and more about geography. He was kept up to date on international news, created his own world map, noting the population of different people groups and the religion of different countries. So studying geography, world history, and his language study, studying Greek, Latin, Hebrew, French, and Dutch. Now, most of his colleagues, fellow ministers, though, were in this camp of what sometimes referred to as more hyper-Calvinists. And this really bothered him because he, as he increasingly had a passion to spread the gospel to the people of the world, he believed that God uses means to do this. And so Carey would eventually write his famous book, which sometimes has been called the Missions Manifesto, or others have referred to it as the Magna Carta, the Protestant Missionary Movement. And here's the long title. You know, in the 17th, 18th century, they were not inclined towards short titles. But here's the title of his book: An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to use means for the conversion of the heathens, in which the religious state of the different nations of the world, the success of formal undertakings, and the practicability of further undertakings are considered. Well, the thrust of it was certainly the means that God uses for the conversion of the heathens. Well, the main points of the book had to do with the fact that the Great Commission is for all Christians and not just intended for the apostles, which had been part of the argument of some of his fellow Calvinistic Baptist brethren. Here's some of the arguments. Carey declared, look, if the Great Commission was only for the apostles, well, then the command to baptize would be too. And what right do we have to be baptizing people? If the Great Commission, he said, was only for the apostles, then all the preaching to heathen would be without any warrant. Or if the command to teach all nations was only for the apostles, then the promise of the divine presence would also be limited. Of course, the end of the Great Commission is, lo, I will be with you always to the end of the world. And Carey says, was this only for the apostles? No, of course not. This was intended for all followers of Christ. Well, in addition, he dealt with some of the other objections that people had to going on world missions. Well, we need to just wait on God's providence. And Carey said, well, God's providence is very self-evident. He's already opened the door. Look at the availability of sea travel. Look at the trading companies that are journeying to the four corners of the world and the places where all these heathen live. He said, your problem is you're enamored with the love of your own ease and well-being. You're unwilling to be inconvenienced for the sake of others. You're worried about the necessities of life. Well, the food that's eaten by the natives is available. It's not the fine European fare that you're used to, but you can learn to eat it. Well, some object to the difficulty of learning languages. And Carey said, look, it takes no great talent to require the learning of any language on earth in a year or two. Anybody can really do that. And so he tried to deal with those practical objections as well as the objections to this idea that, well, the Apostles' Creed is only applicable to the apostles. Well, finally, at a Baptist minister's meeting, Carey proposes to his brethren that they organize a missionary society. Well, his brothers are hesitant at first, and they ask Carey to preach to them at a meeting the following year. And this sermon then, in October of 1792, concludes with the famous line that is attributed to Carey in this sermon: expect great things and attempt great things. So 12 ministers in October of 1792 established a society, as they said, for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen according to the recommendation of William Carey's book, The Inquiry. So Carey then commits himself to be a missionary. The brothers pass around Andrew Fuller's snuff box, which had a picture of Paul's conversion on it, and they collect pledges. And so the English Baptist missionary movement is born. Carey becomes their first missionary, along with John Thomas, who was a Baptist surgeon who had already served in India as a doctor with the East India Company. Remember, British rule was in place in India and parts of India at the time, but the East India Company had not been in favor of sending missionaries. And so this was difficult for him. It actually was illegal for him to enter as a missionary at that time. So he had to get on board a Danish ship as he sailed for Calcutta. And after a five-month village, along with his family, he was let off on a small fishing boat then to float into Calcutta because he had no official permit to enter. And so he arrives on the banks of the Hooghly River in November of 1793. Of course, the difficulty of Carey's early years in India are notorious, and things were horrific for him during this time in this malaria-infested area outside of Calcutta. Very meager resources. Thomas would abandon him to restart his surgical ministry to support himself. Carey, Molly, and his oldest son Felix suffer from dysentery, and this was a very disabling and could be a fatal disease. And they found supporting the family very, very difficult. At one point, William asked Thomas for his share of the missionary savings. Thomas replies, "Well, I've already spent it all to get my surgical business going again." Carey records these very sad words. He says, "I'm in a strange land. I'm alone. I have no Christian friend, a large family, and nothing to support their wants." Well, Carey begins to study the native language of Bengali, and he hires a pundit, which is the name for a native teacher, and begins to preach to the people using a translator, and then also initiated his translation work. Well, they decide to move in from the coast inland and actually move into a more dangerous area full of alligators, tigers, large snakes. I'm sure that was very exciting to Molly and the family, although I'm sure the boys may have enjoyed the excitement of it all. But then he receives an offer to be a manager along with Thomas of an indigo plant in the inland. And this job enabled him to establish legal residence in India. And this would be a mainstay for him for a number of years and would allow him to continue his missionary work, his translation work. So kind of a church planter, if you would, tent-making ministry. And it was through managing this indigo plant that he could do this. But he was very discouraged at the end of this first year, constantly moving, cares of his family, new language, no converts. Carey writes, "When I left England, my hope of the conversion of the heathen was very strong. But among so many obstacles, it would entirely die away unless by God's grace. I had nothing to exercise, but plenty to obstruct it. For now, a year and 19 days. Well, I have God, and His word is sure." So a rather hopeless feeling, but he declares, "I can only hope in God because I'm not seeing much good anywhere else." Things are bad after the first year, and then they begin to get worse. Molly gets dysentery again, and Carey contracts malaria. His son Peter, who's 5 years old, dies from dysentery. And his wife Molly begins her long battle with mental illness. But Carey is relentless in his work on the Bengali translation of the Bible. And finally, after 4 years in India, the New Testament is translated by 1797, and he immediately shifts to begin studying Sanskrit, another language group. Meanwhile, he's supervising over 100 workers at the indigo factory, and he and Thomas set up a school for boys to teach education. And this would put him under the microscope, and he's criticized now by the old missionary society back in England. Say, well, we sense that you're more interested in enterprise and business through the Indigo Factory and the school you're establishing than your conversion of the heathen. Because Carey still had seen no converts, but he is at this time able to preach in the Bengali language. Thomas now would desert him a second time and gets into the rum trade, which is very lucrative at this time. His wife's mental illness, Molly's state is not improving, and his sons have become very unruly. And Carey seems preoccupied with his work, so the efforts go on. The Careys will move another time when this factory closes, and he will open his own indigo factory in Kidderpore. Well, help will finally arrive for William Carey and his family in India, and this will enable him really to turn the corner. Eight missionaries arrive in children here in Calcutta in 1799 after 6 years he had been alone. William Ward is one of the missionaries who's a printer, who's going to be very significant in printing these translations in the different Indian languages and providing other resources for the peoples. Joshua and Hannah Marshman will assist the Carey. Well, finally, in the year 1800, Carey will baptize his first Indian convert after 7 years, Krishna Paul. The Marshmans open a boarding school for both girls and boys, teaching English to the people, and a deluge of students began to come in. And Ward prints a Bengali New Testament in 1801 in the newly established Serampore Press. Carey is appointed teacher at the William College there in Calcutta, where he would teach Bengali and Sanskrit there. This was a school for British civil servants. So involved in education, the Indigo plant, publication, evangelistic work, Carey is a busy, busy man. The work begins to expand. 19 more mission stations will be established, and Carey gets more aggressive in his plans to translate the Bible into the chief language of Hindustani. By 1808, a Sanskrit translation of the New Testament is published. And this is really an incredible thing. Over the next 28 years, he will translate the entire Bible into six languages using different teams of educated Indians that would help him with these languages, and translated parts of the Bible into 29 other languages and dialects, translating grammars, and really made a significant contribution to the English language. His co-workers like to refer to Carey as the machine, which sounds like a very legitimate title for him. Well, some of his translation work was better than others. He was so rushed, and much of it, his speedy efforts to get it done and would have to be fine-tuned later. Some of the translation work was destroyed in a fire of 1812, which was rather sad. But in 1818, Serampore College was established, which was a new missionary divinity school providing ministerial training for all castes and denominations. Eventually, as is sadly the case in the missionary endeavors, there was some tension with some of the younger missionaries and a division with the old missionary society back in England that eventually sent him. But he kept the pace of his work up until the end, and finally Carey would die in 1834. So the great William Carey, English Baptist missionary, would be a precursor of things to come, as Baptist would be such a huge part of the Great Commission among Protestant groups, as the 19th century would become the great Protestant century of evangelistic missions, where Protestantism really would change the face of the globe as Christianity would spread in the 19th century all over the planet. And at the point of the spear, if you would, were certainly the English Baptist missionaries, all influenced and encouraged by the great efforts of William Carey.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.